Welcome to Diversion and Exclusivity, Yusuf's Adventures in Zebra Hunting. This is Yusuf Khatib, CEO and co-founder of Global Skills Hub. I'm incredibly privileged, excited, and a bit nervous as I get to interview my little sister today, Dr. Aisha Khatib, straight from the front lines of COVID-19.
Podcast with Aisha Pupu, the sister of my dad, and she teach me that no matter what, you can do anything, you can save the world. If you, it don't matter what, if it's hard or if it's not hard, we have to save it because otherwise, nothing to do.
So
thank you for having me.
Yes, this is going to be fun. I had this moment of reflection today where I was thinking a lot about, you know, all these crazy experiences that you've had in your life. I mean, you ran with the Olympic torch, you worked in the slums of Pune, you've been in disaster response training, you can kind of say you went to Harvard, you know, even though it was for a week. You've done all these amazing things. You were the team doctor for the New Zealand All Blacks.
Not the All Blacks, the Turbos.
Sorry, let's start from your medical kind of background. What was your passion to becoming a doctor? And then we're going to talk a little bit about what you're up to now with working on the front lines.
All right. Well, thank you for having me, first of all. Yeah, I have to say that I don't know what to expect out of this.
I'm kidding.
So my name is Aisha Khatib, and I am a physician trained in family and emergency medicine. And I recently completed an infectious diseases fellowship, specifically in clinical tropical medicine. And I also have a strong interest and background training in travel medicine. So currently I am the clinical director of a travel medicine clinic in Toronto, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Toronto. And I work also with Toronto Public Health in one of their sexual health clinics in Toronto. So I have a variety of hats that I play in the medical world. And I guess like my passion in becoming a doctor was fueled by, I guess, it was a platform where I could reach people and feel that I could help people on a level that was very holistic and not just medical. So reaching people through social aspects, economic aspects, medical aspects, and kind of trying to provide that holistic care and really actually trying to make a difference in people's lives. Obviously, I had a strong interest in doing international work and global work as well. And I think part of that really stemmed from my love of travel, but also my love of culture and my love of learning about different people's languages and cultures and foods. And I thought that medicine was actually a fantastic platform and vehicle to actually be able to transplant myself into various different populations and learn about them and also learn about what their needs were to see if we were able to provide anything for people, you know, at a global level.
I'm going to interrupt you there for 1 second. So one thing I'm going to say is that most people of late, you know, they say I talk a lot. And so this is great because now they're going to realize that I'm actually not the Khatib that talks a lot.
Okay, so I need to stop talking so much. All right.
No, but this is great. Like, these are all the things that I had a couple of questions because you touched on a couple of things that I wanted to just bring up. You know, one thing is you talked about that global and international work, and you also talked about travel. You know, in terms of the global and international work, you've done, I remember you doing like mock UNs, and that's where, I think that's where you actually met Sachin, you know, who worked with Global Skills.
I hired him, actually.
You hired him? Okay.
Yeah. So I both interviewed him and hired him. That's how I met him.
It's like every Khatib he gets into contact with just tries to hire him.
Yes.
But yeah, and then you did a lot of work around the UN in general. And I think there was a couple experiences that you've had there as well. I remember you calling me in meeting that you had met someone incredibly special. You had met Kofi, or was it? No, you had met.
No. We were able to listen to Kofi at the United Nations in New York at the headquarters there. So that was quite lucky for us. So yeah, no, I in undergrad, before I got into medical school, I was very politically involved, and I actually wanted to go into politics. But I realized that medicine was a better avenue to actually impact change than politics. So
all of our friends in the government, just so you know, you should have been doctors.
Well, I think on an individual level. My role, I did a lot of Model United Nations, but from Model United Nations, though, when I was competing in a lot of those, they were competitions essentially, but a lot of the time I found that I came from a science or a medical background, and a lot of people discussing medical issues at that level were not medical. They were either political science or lawyers or economists or people from very different fields. And so they had a very different understanding about what was the actual need for people in the medical field or dealing with certain health issues. And so I thought that that was a really interesting reason as well for me to go into medicine, was to give a different perspective on the global health level, to provide that basically a different perspective when a lot of decisions often are made from a very, you know, political or policy level that may not have the understanding of the medical nuances of certain health demographics.
Right. I think, you know, and I think that's an interesting point right now, because I learned a lot more of that. You know, I would always hear about your trips, but I was always so busy doing like building something or working on something. And I didn't, you know, we were siloed away from each other, but I would always hear about what you were doing, but not to the level of detail past the 3,000 pictures you would show me from your MacBook. But, you know, I learned about the UN SDG, like literally the day before you and I had that conversation, when I was driving back from Ottawa to Toronto before I left. And, you know, I'd never heard about these things before and so on. And these are things that, you know, the Millennium Goals and all this stuff, this is stuff that you grew up with, that you were so involved with. When you were talking about the impact of all of these policies and the medical sector being connected on a policy level globally, you know, this is stuff that I'm working on and dealing with now. And it's so interesting. And I'm remiss that I didn't get involved sooner, you know, and I wish we had spent more time there, but you know, I'm looking forward to kind of reconnecting on that level with you, with the work that we're doing inside of the health sector now.
And, you know, I think a lot of that, in regards to the Sustainable Development Goals, with a lot of the international work that I've done, they're kind of siloed into certain projects. So for example, in Nepal, we were working on a women's health mission. And when I was in Haiti, we were working specifically, you know, during the cholera outbreak. When I was working in India, we were working with a lot of women, but we were talking about education and we were talking about, you know, those different types of infections. And those are all actually already, they are just outlined in the Sustainable Development Goal. So it's things that already are happening. And I think people were just able to put a label and put a category to it so that it made it better able for people to focus on those projects in specific countries and specific levels.
Okay. So, and let's shift focus a little bit on in terms of travel. You know, I do remember kind of distinctly that when you started to travel, your view and your perspective on the world really changed. You know, I remember you coming back and one day we were sitting there and you were saying you didn't realize how narrow-minded certain, you know, religious groups were, let's say Muslim groups were in certain areas around the world. But then you realized that, you know, like you'd go out there and you started to visit all these Muslim countries and stuff. And you were like, wow, like people are a lot more open-minded to, you know, and it's more of an identity to them, where they're getting comfortable with other cultures and respecting themselves, as opposed to being almost defensive or offensive and saying like, hey, we're just better because we're different and we know something and stuff like that. I saw that big change when you come and travel. Did you feel like that shift happened? Do you remember us having that conversation?
Yeah. And I think there's two specific trips I would say that really brought that to light for me. The first one was my work in India. So I went as a medical student to volunteer in the slums in India, but we were basically working on an HIV/AIDS education project, and we were doing tuberculosis case finding as well. But what I learned there is how diverse India was, actually. And I mean, growing up, you know, we were told we were really Pakistani and Indian and whatnot, and you just kind of assumed it was all the same thing. It's really not.
Yeah.
the cultures are very different. And what I loved about India was I was working in the slums, and you know, these slums are, you have anywhere between 20 to 60,000 people living in a very small area, and they really don't have anything. But you know what's amazing is that they're of all different religions and cultures. So you have everyone from Hindus to Jains to Christians to Muslims to Buddhists, and they all really came together to celebrate different celebrations for different religions. And they were all very interested in kind of where you were from and teaching about themselves as well. And I think that kind of really gave a very different perspective on diversity. The other place I found that really, I think, brought that perspective to light was I was working with Civicus, and Civicus is a civil society organization that was originally founded by Nelson Mandela in South Africa. And they basically came up with this group of the elders. And imagine if the world was a global village, who would be the elders of this village? So I was working on the steering committee for the World Youth Assembly, and we had the privilege of bringing together about 250 youth from all over the world and sharing ideas on different issues that they were facing in different areas, and realizing that they were coming from various countries, various socioeconomic backgrounds, various religions, ethnic differences, gender differences. But the issues that they were dealing with were the same across the board, you know? So I think that that was really eye-opening to me as well, and realizing as well that, you know, there's a sameness in the diversity, but there's also like a blessing in the differences between people that bring to light a lot of different ideas.
Yeah, I think that's powerful. I've said this many times, and it's a quote, one of the most famous quotes that, or favorite quotes of mine, is that, you know, Einstein said it's that the illusion of our differences is an optical delusion of our consciousness. When I remember, I was back in WFG, and there was a sales trainer who came. His name was Lou Garcia. And he was this short little like awesome dude. And he was doing the sales training, and he goes, the fact that we all think that we're different is the greatest indication that we're all exactly the same. You said that, you know, imagine if there was a global village, these would be the elders of that. I want to explain to me, because that's interesting. It's serendipitous. I'm working on a project right now called Global Villages. And, you know, what is a global village in your mind?
Oh, I think a global village would be one where there is an understanding of the layers of needs for people in that village, and knowing that there are people who are going to be talented and have the skills for different areas to provide for different aspects of that village. Being able to let those people develop those skills, but also still at the same time recognizing that everybody is going to be coming together for the benefit of the entire village, because not only is one skill set or one area going to be important, but they'll only be able to function as a well-working and functioning village when all those areas are able to function in concert with each other. And I think the idea of the elders included Mary Robinson, who was the president of Ireland. There's Ella Bhatt, who was one of the first women in parliament in India. It was Kofi Annan. There was Jimmy Carter, Nelson Mandela. Those are just some of the elders that were there guiding us during this time. And there were, you know, more than that, but these are the ones that, you know, I can remember. But they're basically like global leaders who were able to give that guidance and direction for people to kind of work underneath that.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing. You know, we're going to get you back on here for a call in the next few weeks. And this conversation will seem pretty serendipitous to you at that point. But, you know, if that was to exist, and if that was out there, would we be privileged enough to ask you to come onto the board of that, in order to help provide direction based on all of the incredible life experience that you've had?
Oh, I mean, I honestly would be honored to, but I honestly don't think that I even have enough experience compared to some of the people that are out there. So, I mean, I would love to, but I, you know, like I'm just a baby still in the world of learning a lot of what's going on with this and the experiences for sure. So
I'm gonna challenge you on that as your older brother, to look at it from a different perspective. You know, you remember I called you from the airport and I was like, hey, I'm getting onto a plane. There's 12 people on standby in the midst of a freaking lockdown. Am I doing the right thing to take a full flight from Toronto to Turkey to Istanbul? And we had that conversation and it was like a 9-hour kind of a stress out. And then you know, I landed in Istanbul and I got on a plane full of Romanian diaspora who were all coming from places like Italy and like the UK, going to Istanbul to come home for Easter. That's how I landed. And I landed and went into a 14-day quarantine in my house. And I had to make a decision that I asked you. And I said, hey, should I go stay at a hotel before I go home? Right. And, you know, we had that long conversation and, you know, we made that decision. And my family, like Danny and the family here, were just like, hey, like, you're coming home. You know, your family, it doesn't matter. We'll take care of this together. But, you know, those 14 days were incredibly stressful, as they could be for a lot of people. And at that point, I had turned all my energy into finding a solution for this because of you and because I may have inadvertently put people at risk in my house. And they had all agreed to stay locked down and do all that stuff. So those 166 hours passed pretty, pretty intensely for me. And so I think from a, you know, what I've come to understand a lot is that, you know, it's not so much about what you've learned. It's about what you're doing with what you've learned and your continual openness to what's happening around you. If you're grounded in values and principles, like even Ray Dalio wrote an entire book on this, then, you know, I think you've exhibited all those values throughout your life. The learnings that you've talked about, if I could once again say this to you as your older brother, is the learnings that you've talked about and this maturity that you've gone through, all they've ever done, Aisha, is revealed the true person that you already are.
Well, thank you.
You know, I give yourself a bit more credit, right? So, you know, it reminds me, you know, that I sent you something, you know, and you asked me some questions and I sent you a WhatsApp message with a quote on it. Do you remember what that quote was?
Yes. At the moment, I can't. But yes, I do actually remember.
Yeah, so you've gone through some landmark training, which is awesome. I want to ask you some questions about that as well. But, you know, one of the exercises that you needed to do was to find out, you had to ask like 10 people these questions about yourself, right? And they were like, what is the, you know, one of them was like, what are the things that I'm the most, that everyone can count on me and so on and so forth. Do you remember that exercise?
Yes, yes, yes.
Then that seems like a little while ago, right?
It does, doesn't it?
So how I long? Went, that was, I'm just looking this up. That was on February 16th.
Oh my goodness.
And a lot has happened since then. On February 16th, we didn't realize that all of our brothers and sisters, our entire family would be together, minus, you know, our parents and all of the kids. But all of the siblings got together for my 40th birthday. We didn't know that Barbara was going to come or Omar was going to come. Like, it was pretty awesome. But this is what I said to you. You know, we talked a lot about the elders and this keeps coming out. And I once again want you to remind you that I believe this is a serendipitous conversation for you because Nelson Mandela quoted these same words at his inauguration. Oh, and wow. What I sent to you was that our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? And, you know, it goes on to say, actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do, We were born to make manifest the glory of the universe that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. And that was the important part that I wanted you to hear. It was that as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. The easiest way to try to put this into words is what I told you, is that whenever I read this, you are the person who comes to my mind who lives this way and wow. makes me feel liberated to be my best. That was February 16th. And then a whole bunch of shit happened, right?
Yeah, no, I was looking at that message now. I was just thinking, oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So, you know, let's kind of shift gears here. And, you know, I want to ask, you know, we've learned a little bit about you, but there's so much about you that the world needs to know. Like, I really hope that you run day soon, make that decision to write a book. I think that the world needs to hear your story. And, you know, if we can help support you on that, like, I honestly believe that's something you should be doing. And if it's not a book, then to at least start with a blog. But, you know, you need to get on to Pick My Brain, and people need to, you know, people who want to become doctors or, you know, whatever in life, they should interview you to learn that you didn't become a doctor for the sake of being a doctor. You know, you became a doctor to create impact. So right now you're working on the front lines, you know, of this fight. You've been at the testing, you know, assessment centers and so on. Obviously, it's probably like a string of tons of emotions and so on. But kind of give us like, you know, as a public, give us the view of what you see on a daily basis, kind of, and maybe what's changed over the last few weeks as well.
Oh, it feels like years rather than weeks, actually. It's hard to imagine that it's only actually been 6 weeks since all of this really kind of came full-fledged. Yeah, so I have been working at one of the COVID assessment centers, and I would say that I'm probably not one of the ones working with the highest risk patients. There's a lot of healthcare workers and essential workers working with people who are in a lot more dire situations, such as places like the long-term cares, in the shelters, and of course, in within the hospital as well. So, but we're all, you know, there's a brother and sisterhood in the medical field. And one thing that's amazing is that this has been something that came at us out of the blue, in the sense that we were following it. And for myself, as a travel doctor, I was following these cases through Asia as the travel bans were expanding and it was affecting my travelers. But I don't think any of us really expected it to really become this full pandemic worldwide, where we literally have had an impact in every single sphere of the world. On the front lines, essentially, if I break it down, I think the biggest thing has just been the fact that COVID-19 is a new disease that hasn't ever been identified in humans before. And as such, there is a lot that we don't know. And it is so difficult to try to treat people and try to explain this to people when we ourselves are learning this all for the very first time, and with a lot of uncertainty and with things changing on a daily basis. So not only are we learning, sheer amounts of information is coming out in regards to publications, in regards to research. So we're trying to learn exactly about the virus. We're trying to learn about the impact of the virus on it has on the human being. We're trying to learn about, you know, how is this going to affect us down the road in regards to our health? We're trying to learn about treatments. We don't know what treatments are going to be effective. We still don't have a treatment for COVID-19. Right now, it's all symptomatic care and management. So there's no definitive treatment as of yet. We're still working on the vaccine. We don't know when that vaccine is coming out. So there's all of that aspect, which is like a fire hose of information. But you can imagine one day is basically, we're still seeing our patients, whether it's virtually or inpatient. And then on top of that, we're dealing with the information overload. we're also trying to learn this new system of going virtual and trying to make sure that our patients are well looked after on that side of things. We're also trying to deal with the safety issue of making sure that we're protected and we're not harming anybody else in the sense of our family or friends in regards to exposures.
And I mean, you had a scare yourself with that. I mean, that was, those were choices that you had to make and stuff like that as well. I mean, let's just talk about that. I mean, did you sit down and have a chat with Zeki about this? Was it like a conversation like, hey, like, was there ever a chat where it was like, hey, maybe I shouldn't go, or, you know, he was like, I don't want you to be doing this stuff?
I don't think he could stop me from not doing this stuff. Because it definitely is my area of interest. And, you know, for when people, you know, when healthcare workers are needed on the front lines or you're needed in essential care, even this is our job, this is our work. And so very rarely you'll see people stepping down from that. In this situation, it even means in the fact that we're not getting paid in certain situations, or our pays have been cut, or we might not have the right equipment. People are still stepping up to get the job done.
The equipment one is the one that blows my mind. I mean, I was talking to Dr. Roger and Dr. Ray a couple days ago. They told me about this early on. It was one of the things that drives me nuts, is that the equipment, where there was hospital systems around the world that were deciding whether or not their frontline workers needed PPE. And, you know, and you remember you and I having this conversation about like, hey, this is like, there's so much stuff that people need to learn. They don't know even like, you know, like, what do we call them? Doffing and donning procedures and stuff like that. You and I had talked about, but like that PPE situation still blows my mind.
Yeah. I mean, and we're pretty lucky in Canada in that, you know, we've banded together and that we have had a lot of people rally to do PPE drives to make sure that we have enough PPE. But there's still situations where I find that, you know, maybe there are systems where there's not enough adequate PPE, or where people are now using expired masks or having to come up with ways of reinventing ways to re-sterilize masks. And you know, that's just the reality of the situation right now. And they're trying to come up with innovative ways to maintain safety. In regards to the conversation I had with Zeki, it's actually ironic because literally the day before I started working in the COVID assessment center, knowing potentially that I would be at risk, that I told him, like, as of tomorrow, I start working with patients and potentially could come into contact with this. And if I haven't already, now is your chance to leave and go stay with your family, because essentially you won't be able to see your family because of me for the next several months.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think of that factor. I was just thinking about you two.
No. So that was the conversation I had, was that if you want to go stay with your parents or with your brother, now is your chance, because as of tomorrow, you won't be allowed to because of exposure from me. So, and at that point, then, you know, he was like, no, I'll stay. And he actually got sick. So ended up being on quarantine. But anyways, I think it's a challenge that has been a challenge for healthcare workers, especially people who are dealing with, you know, prolonged exposure or high risk exposure in regards to protecting their families. You know, I know of doctors who are staying in Airbnbs, or, you know, are staying in the garage of their house so that they're not actually exposing this to people in their families because of the work exposure that they may have. So, you know, I think it's just been, they told us at the beginning, this is going to be a marathon, and it definitely feels that way. I think everybody's tired. There was in the beginning a lot of anxiety as well. Luckily in Canada, things have been a little bit more stable compared to places like Italy and Spain, and even like things like New York, where we're seeing the death toll. And, you know, the surge in hospital capacity has been overwhelming. We're not out of the woods out yet here. Unfortunately, half of our deaths in Canada would be attributed to long-term care facilities. And it's very tragic. And so people are being redeployed. So people are working in fields that they were not working in previously. So that's another aspect that, you know, frontline workers are needing to relearn skills that they might not have been trained in or specialized in. So, you can imagine that it's a pretty, especially if I haven't been getting back to you, you know, after working a full day, then trying to keep up with the information, trying to keep up with the changing protocols, trying to keep up with what's changing within the city guidelines, within the ministry guidelines. It's been overwhelming, I think, for a lot of frontliners. I think what's amazing, though, is to see the collegiality and the innovation that's coming through, and to see, you know, people stepping up. You know, I've heard of like younger doctors in the ER, you know, offering to stay overnight shifts with an older doctor who might be higher risk to do the intubation so that he wasn't exposed. So things like that, where there's a lot of, you know, care being taken.
Camaraderie,
exactly. Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, one thing that I wanted to, you know, say is that in terms of the, you know, I've also seen a lot of people in the community stand up. And, you know, that's been the, you know, I saw, you know, I was a little disappointed with, you know, some of the response I saw from a lot of the tech industry, where they were really, you know, I sent you that article where the WHO, head of the WHO and the head of the IMF, they're brother and sister. Right. And so they basically posted an article talking about, you know, there's no debate on save lives or save jobs. There's no debate. And this is the head of the IMF and the head of, you know, the World Health Organization. And they're saying it's about save lives right now. And then we'll get to that. And yet so many people out there, they were just so focused on, you know, going out there and trying to, like, you know, create runways, you know, in businesses while the world was on fire, right? And, but I saw some incredible, I've heard of some incredible stories along the way. And, you know, I met with this gentleman, his name is Doug Jones. He's the CEO of Ignite Labs out in Nova Scotia. Just an incredible, incredible human being. And, you know, he rallied the entire 3D printing community. And all they did, the most simplest act they did, is they 3D printed ear savers. So I guess when you put a mask on all day, it really bothers your ears, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, forget all day, even a couple hours.
Yeah,
having that pull behind the ears, it can really irritate the ears. Even just having a mask on your face. I mean, I'll go for a shift for 6 to 8 hours with a mask on and a shield on, and you know, it's exhausting and it's irritating. And yeah, definitely the strings behind the ear, the ear loops, can really irritate and cause a lot of tenderness behind the ear. So people have come up with different ways, like putting buttons.
Yeah, so like this, like, you know, Doug has been 3D printing these ear savers. So, you know, just cool things like that. There's this, I haven't actually ever met her, but there's an entrepreneur named Carla Briones. I follow her on LinkedIn, and she's just been delivering food. And as her business goes out of business, she's been delivering food to frontline workers, and just for free. And, you know, and with a company called Freshy. So it's just cool stories like that of people really stepping up and doing, you know, kind of those things is awesome. And to hear about the camaraderie inside of, you know, what you're talking about.
And there's been amazing support from all over the community, for sure. For healthcare workers and essential workers.
So I want to just kind of, you know, respectful of your time and stuff like that, I want to close up with a few questions about the reason we created ASCO 19 is that you told me right from the beginning that information overload was the greatest challenge, because we were at all different stages of this virus hitting us across the world. We needed information for those different stages. And, you know, you kept telling me about like groups that you were a part of, and, you know, whether it was like, maybe it was Facebook groups or private groups that, you know, that had been created where physicians were just trying to share information. And at the same time, we were, as the public, we were also looking for information, right? Because we were like, the news was saying one thing, Twitter was saying one thing, Facebook was saying one thing, you know, the ants around the corner were saying another, you know, and so it's like the most important thing to protect us and create the actions necessary going forward was information, and it needed to be verified. And so what we did is that, you know, the vision of ASCO 19 was, you know, literally that you wanted in real time information to be shared between frontline verified physicians. So, you know, you remember right in the beginning, there was like, we always use this example, but like near the beginning, they were like, ibuprofen's really bad. Don't take ibuprofen. It's causing something, you know, on the COVID side. And then all of a sudden, you know, a few weeks ago, they realized that it actually wasn't affecting it. And there's been all these other types of things. So what ends up happening is we want to get millions of doctors onto this platform to continually answer questions which are coming in either from the public or from other physicians. And we want the same question to be answered millions of times over. And what we want it to be answered with is the information that's being delivered in real time. And so what rises to the top is this nth opinion. And there's a lot of machine learning and there's a lot of AI that's gone into it, you know, to make it all, you know, to really rise up that nth opinion. But at the end of the day, you know, like it's kind of like a Quora on steroids for frontline physicians and the public. So instead of you having to get all this information overload, you go to the app, you ask the question that you need asked, or you answer a question that you have the capability to answer. And what it does is it's this constant information sharing that's happening. So if all of that information was centralized and you could do that in a completely decentralized and borderless world, how helpful do you think that would be for frontline physicians right now?
I mean, I think it would be not only helpful for frontline physicians, but even for the public. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, and there's a lot of information that, again, conflicting in regards to what people were saying several weeks ago. So I think there's value in having the nth opinion and having a Quora on it. I think the key thing, though, is making sure that it is verified and that the information coming from potentially experts in the field or people as well who have or information that's coming from evidence-based medicine. The problem right now that we're facing with COVID is that there are thousands of preprints and thousands of publications, and not all of them are being peer-reviewed. And that's actually one of the gold standards in medicine to warrant, you know, validity of a study or the validity of information. And I think this is almost a way of peer-reviewing information, actually. It's almost like a different form of it by having these questions asked and having so many physicians come on. Like I said, it's a different platform of peer review, almost, not yeah. specifically of journals, but of information that's being asked. So I think in that way, it's a very useful tool to have.
So in terms of, and this is good, and this is good feedback that, you know, and you know, it was funny because as we were going through all the feedback, I would constantly ask you questions and, you know, and we made mistakes, you know, we made mistakes where we, you know, tried to onboard those 10 doctors right away. And, you know, we were like, got them into a Slack and all these things. You know, my friend Tanya Woods, she always says something very, very eloquently. And she says that, you know, tech is siloed. We thought we were out there helping people, but we always were like, you know, we were telling everyone, hey, we have a better way. Come to our boat. And what we should have done the entire time is gone to your boat, you know, and then said, hey, how can we implement tech there? And so, you know, getting you doctors onto Slack, first of all, and trying to get your opinions, I mean, that was a complete disaster. Half of me was like, how are these guys doctors? And then the other half of me is like, why can't a doctor use Slack? Why hasn't anyone ever thought about that?
Well, right? You know, I think there are doctors using Slack. I know a lot of the Emerge docs, they love Slack. But I think you have to also remember the context, right? The context is that we were learning about five different systems all at once because right. of this. We were learning all this new information. So to add on something else that we had to learn at that time when we were already overloaded, you have to think about the challenge in that as well.
Yeah, and which is, you know, where the challenge here with onboarding this into the physicians is going to be the same. Now all it is it's a really simple sign up on the physician side, and then we've got a verification system set up, and we are verifying every physician that comes on. And so, you know, we will continue to do that. Let, you know, the feedback that we would want from the, you know, physicians is to continue to tell us stuff like that you're telling us. But, you know, it's so simple to ask a question, and it's incredibly simple to answer a question. So this is like, you know, you're sitting there and taking a 15-minute break and you know, and you're doing your peer review really quickly. And, you know, you're literally helping that information out because this, you know, situation is evolving as we go. But, you know, I appreciate that. And it's important to know that that was the reason, because I saw the information overload that was coming to you because you were downloading it to me. You know, you were explaining to me. Remember, we were having all those rapid, fast WhatsApp conversations on like, should we do this? Should we do this? Do you want me to make this for you? Do you want me to make this for you? And I was like, I'll make, you know, remember what I said? I said, it doesn't matter what it takes. I'll make whatever it takes to help you. Right. And you, and what was interesting is that you never asked for you. Right. You said, can you make something to help my friends? You know, you were, I remember us having that conversation about who's the friend of ours that's in Italy, the doctor that you have out there. You know, like you had a friend of yours out there, then you had a friend in the other parts of the world. And, you know, it was about, you were like, how do we help all of these people? And you were like, I can disseminate information.
Right.
So, okay. So, you know, we're coming up on an hour here and I want to make sure that, so I do have a couple questions that I do want to finish up with. You had no idea that this video was coming out. How did you find out? What happened? I want to know the entire story of this. How did you learn about this video?
I got a message on my phone from Melanie, one of my dearest childhood friends. And she just messaged saying, I miss you. I just saw your brother's YouTube video and it makes me so happy. He loves you so much. And so do I. Be safe. And I basically was like, what is she talking about?
So just to pause for a second. So for those of you listening who haven't, you know, learned is I, you know, I was sitting there and I was trying to figure out how to tell Aisha that the app was ready to launch. And we were ready to launch. And I'm like, I'm sitting there and I start writing this letter over and over and over again. And I had Adina on our team and I had Sherry on our team, like them. And Labiba looked at this letter and we just couldn't get it right. And then finally, we realized that it's going to be a video. It's going to be a letter that I'm going to read out to you. And Sherry wrote the final kind of like draft by combining about 50 letters that I had written to you. Oh, is how this actually came together. So that's why it's interesting for us. And we put together this video and Sherry was up all night and it was just wonderful. And then we were supposed to launch and a major publication in Canada said they wanted to carry us. And so I didn't launch the video onto Facebook or anything like that because I thought they were going to launch it. And so we're waiting and we're waiting and we're waiting. And then a day goes by and then a second day goes by and everyone's like, Yusuf, when are you launching this video? And then finally, we were very, you know, happy and fortunate that The Logic decided to pick up the story. And on top of that, I called Mom. And Mom saw the video 24 hours before. And so she got to see the video before anyone else in the family got to see it. She was a little sad and upset about it in terms of like, she was like, wow, what a powerful video. And then so she tagged you. That was her job, was to tag you and post it on Facebook. And then a trickle effect was supposed to start from there. And then I posted. Mom was the first person who posted that video to tag you. And so you then get this message from Mel. You go and then you go watch the video. And what happened?
I was just shocked. it was overwhelming for sure. I really wish I hadn't sent you some of those photos. I didn't look so great. It's like, oh man, you used that photo?
I knew I was going to get in trouble for a couple of them. When Sherry sent that goggle one back, I was like, I'm going to get killed. She's going to kill me.
It's like, oh man.
But there were some powerful photos in there. And what I realized is, I don't think you have had much time to decompress because you've been so busy. You probably got to see a bit of a story in those photos that you probably have taken, shared, but not really seen a lot of in the past few weeks.
Well, I think it was just more like a bit of like a reflection about this is what's happened in the last few weeks for sure. I think also, you know, like one of the things it also made me realize is that, you know, I think part of it is too that I'm just one of so many stories and my story isn't even, you know, like this is how much emotion it brought up just from this story, but just the stories that I'm hearing from colleagues and other people on the front lines are, you know, like a million times more heart-wrenching and emotional, and you realize that everybody has a story, and there's so many individuals that are just kind of being, yeah, this is the front line, but they're people. They have different lives and they have different families, and they're all kind of putting everything on hold for this. So I think you kind of, it was a bit of like reflection and just a bit of like standstill to be like, okay, here we are right now. And it was amazing also to see that from that conversation we had at the very beginning, you know, to see where the app has kind of come from and to see how it developed kind of over time with kind of your experiences as well, and how you perceived things to kind of unfold, because I think it is a very different perspective coming from you than from myself, because definitely I wouldn't have ever even thought of putting a story like this together about me, because, you know, I'm in it, I'm living the story.
Right.
So, yeah, so it was really interesting actually to kind of stand back and take a look at that, and also to see what you guys have created from it, which is, I think, pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, like, I take zero credit. I mean, this is all Dr. Ray and Dr. Rogers' vision. I can't wait for you to meet them. They're incredible human beings. They've heard so much about you, you know, that they are dying to meet. They're always like, Aisha this. This is like, you're on my conversation every time I talk, you know, with them. You're so right, though. Everyone does have a little story. Everyone has their own story in this. The thing is that we're collectively, as humanity, for the first time in a long time, going through a common challenge or a common enemy or a common fight. And it really allows us to give us that time to say, you know what, I'm going to play at my absolute best. I'm going to do whatever I'm greatest at. You know, it ties you back to the values that are the most important to you. You know, it's, you know, we talk about being family first, and then, you know, from family, if you're able to take care of your family, you're able to take care of your neighbor. And if you're able to take care of your neighbor, you can take care of a village. And if you take care of a village, you know, that's where, you know, you can take care of everything. And it was incredibly important to me, knowing the resources that I had access to by having access to the world's best developers, that how could I not deploy and go ask them, you know, would you help me for my sister? Because they had a sister, they had a brother, they had an aunt, they had, everyone knew someone who was in the medical field. There's a gentleman named Tunji, and he's a software developer from our community. He's from Nigeria. And from Nigeria remotely, he's been working on this app. And he says, things are difficult in the world right now. Most people feel powerless. They wish they could do something. And he goes, I'm just glad I was able to do something, however small. So that guy, you know, this awesome dude in Nigeria helped do this, you know, for the physicians. And we have another person, her name is Anastasia. She's from Russia. So she's from our community. She goes, you know, I never had an experience of contributing to an open source project, but I decided that I needed it. And when I saw Yusuf Khatib announce in the GSH community that we had this open source project in order to inform people about COVID, you know, I understood that this is a project that the world needed badly. She goes, I didn't do enough for the project, but I felt like being part of something big and important. And I do think that this great idea will make an incredible impact to deliver information from experts around the world. And it's a brilliant idea. So you got someone from Russia, you got someone from Nigeria, we had people from India, we had Canadians, we had Americans, like exactly like the Civicus that you attended, you had that developing this for you and for all the physicians around there. So we're going to finish up here because, you know, we've gone way over. We probably could go for another hour. This has been fun. But let me ask you, you know, one last kind of quick question, and then we have to do what I do at the end of every podcast. So the last question that I have for you is, you know, what's your kind of final message to the public in terms of, you know, there's a lot of conversations going on right now where a lot of questions are being asked about, you know, the next steps. And, you know, what would you kind of sum up for yourself? I'm not talking about should we open up or not open up, those things, but talking about like understanding people's mindsets, you know, what would you like to share with the public right now as a frontline physician?
I think my message to the public is that you are actually the front line. The community is the front line. It's not us. we're in the back. You know, we're the ones, you know, supporting, you know, the medical side of it. But this is only going to be stopped or thwarted or curbed with the input and the efforts from every single person in the public and in the community around the world, because it's preventative. And by people following public health orders, by people following the guidelines, by people following those recommendations, coming up with innovative ideas, you are all on the front lines. And like I said, to make a village work, you need to acknowledge everyone's specialty and have that work in concert. It's not just the doctors, it's not just the nurses, it's not just the essential workers, it's all of us. We're all in this together.
That's incredibly powerful. I never even thought of it from that perspective. That is, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Okay, so three quick questions for you. We ask this at every podcast that we've done so far. They're rapid fire, so you have to go off the cuff. There's nothing long. Quick, quick, quick. Are ready?
Okay.
Question number one, what is the one thing that every kid like Arman, Samir, and Yusuf around the world that you wish that they would know?
That they're loved.
What's the one food you must have if you're isolated for 14 days?
Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
What flavor?
The Daily Show.
You know, the last question I'm going to leave you with is, you know, we're all going through our own battles and stuff like that. But I know that, you know, this is an incredibly difficult time and different time for our mom. So if there's a message that you could leave with your mom right now, what would it be?
That she is doing an amazing job and that she is basically supporting her entire family. And that, again, she's just as much of the frontline worker as we are. And she's doing an amazing job in her community to deal with this issue as well.
Yeah. I'm incredibly proud of her. I think that the actions that she's taken, they're difficult decisions she's having to make on a daily basis, being involved in the funeral society of of the mosque in Edmonton. And I'm incredibly proud of her. We were talking about with the boys that she's going to be doing some, she's going to be spending some time to do some teaching with them, and we're excited about that.
And honestly, like, everyone in the community loves her, and she's never alone. I think that's the other message. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, how could you not? And as you know, when and we do come from an incredible community, I think is important. Is, you know, we're one of the things I felt in Ottawa was that it was like another Edmonton. I've made a lot of friends in Ottawa as I was there 3 or 4 times over the course of, you know, January and February in 2020. And yeah, so I think that we have a great community that we came in from, and that's probably why we've always tried to search out these global villages wherever we go, whether it's Toronto where we live right now, or when you lived in New Zealand and so on. Once again, thank you for everything. Please share the app and the video with as many people as you can. Get as many of your frontline physicians to get on it. You know, if after answering 1, 2, 3, 4 questions and they don't see the value or they find it, then it's great. At least we'll know. But I need them to answer a question on there. And if they can do that, I really think that we can truly get to what healthcare was meant to be, which is completely decentralized and completely borderless. And physicians like yourself who want to go out there and just spread the right information, please give our incredible, you know, so much gratitude and love to all of your physician friends, everyone that's in your network, you know, to all the healthcare workers around the world. You know, I'm Aisha's older brother, but, you know, this app, think of it as your older brother or your your friend type of thing.
Thank you so much. And thank you to your team for everything you guys are doing.
For sure. Take care.
Bye.